Well, I'm thinking about becoming a movie producer because I've come across a really good storyline. It's a story about this king, head of state of a country that was along one side of a river, ruled by a king who was big. Okay, he's actually overweight. And he liked pushing his weight around. He was a very, very pushy guy. And one of the first things he did, in fact, was there were two other kings that had kingdoms on the same side of the river as he did. And he bullied them to where pretty soon they were doing whatever he said. So you got this king, big king. In fact, for the story, we're going to call him King Big Shot, all right? King Big Shot. He liked power. And then he liked money, because for him money was power, power was money. I think you understand the concept. On the other side of the river was whom he considered his real enemy. There were some odd people on the other side of the river, the west side of the river, and the kings on the east never did like this new power. And I say new because they hadn't been there all that long. They'd only been there some 70 or 80 years. They were newcomers. They had come in and just basically annihilated everybody in this choice land. In fact, we're going to call that land the beautiful land. They had come in, they had killed everybody just about and taken over and moved in and said it was their right to have it, in fact. And in that day, might makes right, so it really wasn't that far-fetched. They were powerful, but they weren't well liked by the neighboring countries. Well, King Big Shot, he had, as I said, gotten the other two countries to go along with him, whatever he said, and it was time for him to make his big move across the river. And so he led the forces across the river, these combined three countries on the east, crossed the river, moved into the beautiful land, and, you know, it turned out to be a cakewalk. I mean, they picked off people all the way in, and they moved in, and they took over, and in fact, Big Shot decided, I like this place, and he decided to live there, at least in summers. And so he built himself a summer palace in what he thought was the prettiest city of all, the City of Palms. Guess why it's called the City of Palms? Yeah, it had palm trees. It was a really nice place. And so he set up in there, and he would have had the power to probably destroy a bunch of people, but he decided not to do that because he thought to himself, I like money. And so why would I destroy all this productivity here? Let's just subjugate them and demand that they give me all their tribute. Now that meant after harvest, basically, you bring me everything except what you need to subsist on. And it was high demands, and it was money, and it was grain. It was everything that said wealth in that day. And so every year at tribute time, they would come moving in to the country and give everything to Big Shot, who now occupied. Now, the way he maintained his power, he had 10,000 troops come in with him. And so really, there was no chance for anybody to rise up because they had an occupying forces there. This had gone on some 18 years. And every summer, King Big Shot moved out to his summer palace, looked out the window, enjoyed the breeze, looked at the view. And on his favorite day, which is the time we're coming to, on his favorite day, the tribute came. So he's looking out his window, and sure enough, here comes the delegation from the beautiful land people. Rows of men carrying sacks of grain, sacks of money, all for him. Led by the procession or delegation was led by a man we're going to call Mr. E. Okay, Mr. E was a recognized leader among these subjected peoples, and somehow King Big Shot just liked it better if one of the respected guys led that. It just made him feel more powerful, and of course, it made Mr. E look all the more humiliated. But they show up and they bring all the stuff, they put it all down, and Mr. E has a little conference with King Big Shot, and accounting is everything here, it's all here. Everything was going as planned, and so they unload the donkeys and the sacks and all that, and they all head back out of town, I'm sure with proper bowing and so forth, and they head back out of town. But just a couple of miles outside of town, Mr. E, from the beautiful land, tells the guys that had carried the stuff, you go on home. I've got to go back and tell the king something. They looked at him, and okay, and Mr. E goes back all by himself. And when he gets there to the summer palace of King Big Shot, he says, I'd like to have a word with the king in private, please. It raised some eyebrows by the security guys, but they passed the message on. The king said, he came alone. No problem. Have Mr. E come on in. And didn't perceive any problem. But we, the ones watching the movie, we know something's afoot here, because we have seen that Mr. E came armed. We know that Mr. E had made himself an 18-inch sword. And at great risk, he concealed that weapon that day, and he was carrying this sword. And he didn't put it on the outside of his clothing, of course, because he'd have it confiscated then. He put it underneath his clothing, and he didn't put it at the traditional place where you'd even carry a weapon, which is on your left thigh. Right-handed person, you'll go like this. Because you see, Mr. E was left-handed. And so he put the weapon under his clothes here. Smaller, concealed, nobody caught him. So he walked in for an audience with King Big Shot, and he's ushered into this breezy room, and King Big Shot is kind of gloating over everything that's just come his way, and he says, so what can I do for you, Mr. E? We now take you to a commercial break. No, I'm kidding. We're back. Mr. E looks at King Big Shot, bows slightly, and says, I have a message for you, O King, from God. And these words are kind of strange, and the obese king struggles to his feet like, what's this? And Mr. E quickly pulls out his homemade sword and plunges it into the belly of King Big Shot. In fact, he pushes it way in and does not even bring it out. And King Big Shot crumples to the ground. And Mr. E leaves him there, walks to the door calmly, locks it behind him, goes out on the porch, past the security guys, nods to him, thank you for your time, and walks calmly down the road. Nothing seems to be amiss at the palace. King is in there, and they kind of wait around, and a little later on, they get a little concerned. They try the door. It's locked. Oh, he must be going to the bathroom. Give him time. They wait a little longer, and man, it's been a long time. And so they call to the king, and they don't get an answer. And finally, someone goes and gets the key and opens it up and find the king lying dead on the floor. Well, by this time, Mr. E is long gone. He has run later some 5-10 miles to the town of Syrah. He takes a trumpet and blows it and announces that King Big Shot is dead. 18 years of tyranny bringing tribute to King Big Shot is over. Follow me. We'll take him. Meet me at the river. And from village to village, the word goes out, and people are finding their hidden swords and axes and knives, and they head to the river, and the 10,000 occupying troops that have been in the country do not have time to organize, but as Mr. E guessed, they are running for home, but they got to pass the river at the fords. That's where the only place you could do it. And as they came, Mr. E and the warriors now of the beautiful land mowed them all down. And Mr. E ruled the country. So the movie's over and credits are running. And there's a little frame with some video on the side as the credits roll. And you see a picture of guys coming from harvest with smiles on their faces, carrying the baskets of grain home for family and for storage. You see a family reunion and grandpas with babies on their knees. And you even see an ancient calendar flipping and years roll by, 80 years of incredible joy and peace and prosperity. And the final frame has one of those little lines, and it says, based on an absolutely true story. It's Judges 3. And Mr. E is Ehud, the judge, the honored warrior and judge of Israel. And King Bigshot is King Eglon of Moab across the river, which is the Jordan River. King Eglon had a summer palace in the city of Palms. It really was called that, but it's better known as Jericho, just on the Israel side of the river. And for some 18 years, he had ruled that land until this incredible event. And the beautiful land, that's actually a biblical name for Israel in the book of Daniel. And so we borrowed that too. So as we go through this, and we will read it as well, just so you know I didn't make stuff up, because actually I didn't embellish the story at all, apart from the commercial and the credits. It's actually all in there. Is this a story of a human hero? We'd say, yeah, it would make a movie, wouldn't it? It's a human hero indeed, but it's really a story about God, because this is God's book, and it's always about God. And even Ehud would tell you it wasn't about him. Though we admire him, it was actually his confidence in God that made the difference. So, a couple of things to just note from Ehud that are examples worth following. One that strikes me, first of all, is his courage. That seems incredible. Put yourself in that story. He risked death by planning all this, didn't he? I mean, you can just see the tension building like it is sometimes when you're watching a spy movie or something that, you know, at any point, he could have been caught. Let's catch up the story. Verse 12 of chapter 3 tells us this cycle that characterized the time of the judges. We looked at this in detail last week more. A cycle in which Israel, when they were blessed, proceeded to just sin away the time of blessing, didn't they? Isn't that a tendency? Once again, though, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel. So God brings discipline as they are falling into sin. Verse 13, getting the Ammonites and Amalekites to join him, Eglon came and attacked Israel, and they took possession of the city of the Palms. The Israelites were subject to King Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. Again, the Israelites cried out to the Lord. Isn't that what we do next? We're at the script. And he gave them a deliverer. Incredible grace. After sinning and getting what they deserved, they cry out to God and he sends them a deliverer. Ehud, a left-handed man, the son of Gera the Benjamite. The Israelites sent him with tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Ehud had made a double-edged sword about a foot and a half long, which he strapped to his right thigh under his clothing. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab, who was a very fat man. After Ehud had presented the tribute, he sent on their way the men who had carried it. At the idols near Gilgal, he said, he himself turned back and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. The king said, quiet, and all his attendants left him. Ehud then approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his summer palace and said, I have a message from God for you. As the king rose from his seat, Ehud reached with his left hand, drew the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. Even the handle sank in after the blade which came out his back. Details we maybe didn't all need to know. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it. Then Ehud went out to the porch. He shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. After he had gone, the servants came and found the doors of the upper room locked. They said, he must be relieving himself in the inner room of the house. They waited to the point of embarrassment, but when he did not open the doors of the room, they took a key and unlocked them. And when they saw that, they saw their Lord fallen to the floor dead, just that far for now. Wow, what a risky plan, huh? Would you have done that? I don't know. I'm not a violent guy, number one, but I don't think I'm that good of a risk taker either. Not only did he have the courage, though, he also had the trust in God. He executed his plan calmly under pressure. He had to be shaken in his boots in one sense, but he walks out the door. See you guys. Calm under pressure because he saw this as a God thing and he was following God's direction, though it, I'm sure, was his plan. Third, I see a shrewdness. Ehud realized, perhaps, that the only way to win was by working alone. Eglon had about 10,000 troops. Let's just keep reading. We'll come across that. While they waited, verse 26, Ehud got away. He passed by the idols and escaped to Syrah. When he arrived there, he blew a trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hills, with him leading them. Follow me, he ordered, for the Lord has given Moab, your enemy, into your hands. So they followed him down, and taking possession of the ford of the Jordan that led to Moab, they allowed no one to cross over. At that time, they struck down about 10,000 Moabites, all vigorous and strong. Not a man escaped. That day, Moab was made subject to Israel, so it completely turned, didn't it? And the land had peace for 80 years. How do you raise up an army to even fight when they're all occupying your country? 10,000 troops spread out, they would be found out. And so as God seems to have put this on the heart of Ehud to deliver the people, he shrewdly thought, you know what? This is something I am going to have to do or start alone. And I realize that I'm the guy who has to trust God on this alone. I don't even think that he told his plan to the people that helped carry the tax or the tribute. Because you don't want to have somebody going along with you who caves into the pressure at the end or says something stupid. It's just him. He plans it. He executes it. And he does it flawlessly. Fourthly, spiritual leadership. Ehud trusted God, but what else? He invited others to act based on faith in God as well. You see, it starts with one, and then faith in God can spread. And so he invites others to join him. And as he does that, did you notice the humility that Ehud gave God the credit? If there ever was a time to exalt yourself, you know, hire an agent and be somebody, this was the time. But what did he say in verse 28? Follow me, for the Lord had given Moab, your enemy, into your hands. He doesn't take credit for himself. He knows that this incredible victory, the plan, the wisdom, the safety, the execution of the whole thing, this was God. And that is courage then worth following. Why is this in our Bible? You know, you ever ask that as you're reading certain things? It's a good question. Why did God? Because God put it in there for a reason. These are interesting stories. Is it to keep our interest so we stay awake reading the thing after we've, you know, because you're going to come across Chronicles sometime and read all those lists of names or something? But why is it in there? It's in there because it's teaching us something about God and about how we're supposed to respond to God. And what stands out to me is the aloneness of Ehud, that he did not have the support system to plan this, I don't think. There's no mention of a consortium of people that got together, let's do this, we did this. It was God working in one man, the power of one, but it's not Ehud, it's God. First issue to think about is that courage is being willing to trust God, even if it seems no way out, even if it seems we're the only one doing it. You know what? Sometimes we will not have support in our faith in God. Sometimes we just have to believe God ourselves. We can be a minority of one and be right if it's based on the character and the promises of God. This isn't saying that advice isn't important. But there's points at which we have to be alone. Sometimes it seems like even in Christian fellowship circles, as problems are discussed, everything seems to be horizontal, just as if non-Christians were discussing this in another setting. There's really no difference because you talk about, well, the pros and the cons and well, there's this, we don't have enough money, this doesn't seem, it didn't work before, and it probably is impossible. And it's all just this human endeavor. And there's a time at which we have to go from horizontal thinking to vertical thinking and saying, but what about God? I mean, who is He? And what does He want? And so whatever obstacles, if this is a God thing, and again, it's not going against wisdom or leadership or destroying the family over some harebrained idea kind of a thing, but if God is in this, then the obstacles are going to fall. Trusting God sometimes means doing it alone. And you know, we get plenty of practice at that because there are some things that by nature of the circumstances, we do face them alone. If there's difficulties in the marriage, and since the marriage just has two, if there's difficulties, the difficulty that you're facing is alone, isn't it? And you might try to get support or whatever, but ultimately, you're alone. Financial things, that's a... You know, it's personal finances many times. And you feel alone. Health, you know, it's your body. You're alone with what is going on, whatever your fears are. Relationships, usually it's this person, that person. And so, there's a lot of alone things. Have we learned to be alone and still believe God? Can we stand alone where necessary? A second principle about wisdom. It means to seek solutions from God that require me to trust, but also to act. The path of wisdom is not a fail-safe, no risk, I know exactly how this is going to work out kind of a thing. It's going to take acting, in fact, when we don't know how it's going to turn out. Now, let's balance that with the fact that sometimes faith means waiting. In that sense, you could say it's passive, but sometimes waiting is a very active thing because you want to go out there and do something and manipulate something and say something and often mess something up. And so sometimes the action step is sit and be still for a while. But it's not really faith, though, if you know how it's going to turn out completely. Faith means that we have to act in some way apart from knowing the future. But it's acting with confidence based on who God is. That's what the faith chapter of Hebrews is about. Acting on faith when we don't know the ending. Hebrews 11, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. As people have different translations to translate that verse, it kind of can give it a different twist and you assume one thing or another. But it looks to me that what he is saying is that we can be confident of the things that God says we can be confident about, even though they haven't happened yet. We can be sure of that which has been promised. It's not just like hope for, you know, we can't be sure the Packers are going to beat the Bears today. That's not a sure thing. Hopeful, that's how we use hope, but it really means based on the promises of God. So faith is being sure of what we hope for, certain of something we do not yet see. And we know that's the idea because you go into the rest of the chapter and you find examples like Noah and Abraham. By faith, Noah, when he was warned about the things not yet seen, there's going to be a flood, cover the whole earth. Oh, there was a lot of precedent for that, wasn't there? So, yeah, seriously, God said there's going to be a flood over the whole earth, so what you really need is a boat, and it's going to be this big, and you're going to build it. And he did. Built an ark to save his family. No place to float the thing, no apparent need for the thing, but he built it because of what God said. Abraham. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, the land of Israel that we're talking about here, that God eventually to there and took occupation of it, he obeyed and went even though he did not know where he was going. Don't you hate it, wives, when your husbands are driving and they don't know where they're going and they won't admit it, probably? Did Abraham know how to get there? Maybe he knew the basic trade route, but where he was headed. But I think this is saying he didn't know what lay ahead. He didn't have a travel brochure that said, this is what you got, and you got reservations at such and such. And none of those details were filled in. In fact, he didn't even know the timeline and how long he would spend in Haran and when his dad would die and when he'd finally get down there. And then he went through his whole life, and he really didn't seem to have made any progress on owning the land of Israel, did he? It was hundreds of years later where his descendants did. And so, man, he had to operate in the dark about so much stuff, but what if he hadn't gone? You know, he was laying a foundation for actually later generations. And we can become so sure that God has to do everything for me and preferably by the end of the day. And not realizing that so much of the obedience that God asks of us is long term, is big picture, that what we really accomplish in our life is not all that we accomplish in our life. Not if you have children, not if you have influence on other people's children, not if you have friends. God is multiplying our lives. And so there's a whole big future out there. So we can't get all upset about the fact that I didn't get this done, or life is getting away from me and this didn't happen. And really, that's just saying that we are focusing on what we would enjoy. Abraham knew better. He said, I will believe God even though it's not happening for me in the way I thought it would now. So wisdom is to seek for solutions without knowing exactly how it's going to turn out. Spiritual leadership is asking others to actively trust God with you. It's all about trust. And so at some point, the faith of the one became the faith of the many, didn't it? And he blew the trumpet, and now that got everybody else over the hump. And they ran and got their weapons, whatever it took, and joined Ehud in this amazing victory. But it took somebody to start it, and then that somebody to say, hey, come along with me. Men, if we're married, does our wife know that we trust God? Now that's, how will she know that? Well, there has to be some kind of track record where we've had to. And so the problems we've faced are not the disasters necessarily. They're the opportunities to develop that track record. Do our children know that we trust God as moms and dads? And do the people that are in our ministries that we lead know that? If you ask a teenager who's going through a hard time, maybe in your home, say, you know what, you've got to really trust God with this. Is that hollow sounding to them? It will be hollow if they've never seen us trust God in some real way. But have they seen us? Have we shared what we've gone through as we've gone through it before we knew the ending? Have they heard us say, but we really believe God's going to do something great through this. We really think God's going to take care of this. Or have they just seen us go to pieces? What does that teach? That teaches when hard times come, go to pieces. Or do they see this settled sense of confidence in God? I'm glad that in my younger years, as we were growing up on the farm, that there was a kind of a string of bad years. Looking back, I realized I got to participate in observing and seeing the development of my parents' faith financially because they went through those hard years when it wouldn't rain, there were no crops, couldn't pay the bills. Dad had to go and borrow money to live on and buy groceries. And so we would pray for rain. We look out to the west and hope that it'd rain and pray that it would rain. And yet God took care of us through all of that. And I'm so glad. Are we developing a track record? Are we always going to find a human way to solve, manipulate? I mean, it's not that we're supposed to sit there and wait for nothing, but is there an active sense of trusting God that those watching us, particularly if they're in our home, would know? Leaders say, trust God with me before we see how it turns out. In fact, is it really trust in God if we know the ending? Not really. Anybody can trust God if you know the ending. We know the ending of Scripture, but we don't know the ending of our situation until time brings us to that point. So that's the story of Ehud. There's another story, though, in Judges 3 of another judge. It wouldn't be that hard, I suppose, for someone who knows how to make movies to do Ehud, but what about this next guy? You see there's another one here in chapter 3? Shamgar. What would make the movie difficult to produce is you'd have to make up the whole storyline yourself. Except for one striking detail. After Ehud came Shamgar, son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. I mean, to me, he's just as impressive as Ehud. I just wish I knew more how it happened. In fact, we don't even know, was this a single battle? I mean, was it Israel coming against the Philistines and Shamgar ran out ahead and took care of it all beforehand? Or did some Philistine army contingent come upon Shamgar and he was, you know, backed in a corner and he fought his way out all at once? Was it a kind of a thing over a couple of months or years during this threat of Philistines attacking and pushing into your territory and whatever? And so Shamgar carries out some kind of a vigilante kind of, or whatever kind of thing, you know, get a few here, get a few there. We really don't know how this story all went, but God told us just enough that we have to respect and really honor this guy for trusting God in much the same way. It seems that Shamgar had this big victory over the Philistines probably during that 80-year period of peace. And the reason we say that is because you go to the next verse, chapter 4, verse 1, it says, after Ehud died. So Shamgar is after Ehud, but so is the next story, Deborah, which suggests that probably Shamgar and his exploits against the Philistines happened during the same time. And it may have been that his was more of a regional thing, whereas Ehud's was a more major thing. If you picture it on a map here, here's the kingdom of Moab on the east side of the river, the story of Ehud. And Eglon came from Moab along with the Ammonites and actually the Amalekites. And they came in across the river, and it seemed to be a broader thing, and the Israelites came from from the hills and gathered together, whereas the Philistine issue here might have just been kind of a smaller regional attack that Shamgar is raised up there. Okay, what about the ox goad? That's the interesting part. We don't know much about ox goads, but it's basically a big stick. If you, I've read that they could be up to like 8 feet long, 6 to 8 feet long, and that sometimes the one end would be like a fence post. You know, if it's a tree, you know, it could be thicker over here. It might be 6 inches big over on this end, and the other end sometimes they would put iron on and sharpen it. And it's a cattleman's tool. I mean, you got to move these lumbering beasts along, and so you'd poke them, and you could kind of knock them upside the head if you needed to shift them over or something. It got the job done. It's not a weapon. Neither is a baseball bat, but you know, sometimes baseball bats become weapons. And so he used an ox goad. Amazing story as well. A couple of the examples we might see from him, and again, it's got to be faith. There's no mention of his faith or giving God the credit or all that, but we just kind of assume this guy knew where his power came from for this incredible victory. Shamgar trusted God to help him overcome extreme odds, defeating 600 Philistines. Who else single-handedly took on Philistines that well? Samson. How many? Did he kill one time with a jawbone of a donkey? 1,000, good. You don't have to come to that, whoever said that. You don't have to come to that message later on. But so he's in that class. This is a world-class Philistine killer that's right up there with Samson. He trusted God to do that. Secondly, the creativity. He used an unconventional weapon to battle the Philistines. You know, at Philistine boot camp, ox goads weren't in the manual, I don't think. They had never faced one before, and I can just imagine that they knew about swords and spears. You can throw the sword, spears, and you can do close battle with the sword, and you guard against this. what do you do with an 8-foot, you know, swinging, let's say, swinging ox goad? They'd never faced that one. So maybe God used kind of the unconventional nature of it, the element of surprise, to give him the edge as well. Creativity. Then finally, courage. Again, in a time of fear. Shamgar fought when others wouldn't even travel roads in fear of attack. You see, Shamgar actually does get another verse in the Bible. Turn ahead to Judges 5, verse 6. In the Song of Deborah that we'll study at another time, he is mentioned because it's the same era. But it says, in the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the roads were abandoned. Travelers took to winding paths. What that's telling you is that the Israelites were so afraid that they wouldn't even use the main roads because they'd be seen. They could be attacked. They could be killed. And so they did only the bare essential travel. And the way they would do it is they would take the little winding path. You know, maybe they knew a place you could sneak through and through the bushes, you know, along the river or whatever. But no one's going to go on the main road these days. Shamgar, I think, took the main roads. Maybe that's where he got his 600 tally. He was on the main roads, and he was so successful at it, trusting God and winning, that I think the Philistines eventually went back because they didn't want to be on the road if Shamgar was on the road. So he had courage in a time of fear. I don't think it's saying that Shamgar didn't fear, but he had courage in spite of his fear. Once again, it started with one man, didn't it? It's a man who says, I will believe God and I will fight for the right. You know, I will stand up for God and his people and deliver Israel, even if I'm the only one. We are so peer conscious that it controls, it dominates us sometimes, doesn't it? That we live our life under a banner that says, what will people think? As if our goal was to make people think right of us. What's happening is that we're, again, living horizontally instead of vertically. What if we lived with the thought, what will God think of what I'm about to do? That's the only thing that matters. What will God think? A faith principle. Faith is trusting that God can use me differently than he uses others. An ox goad. I suppose Shamgar had to think, you know, what I am is a cattleman. I'm not a soldier, but God's put it on my heart, something's got to be done about this Philistine problem. And what I'm comfortable with, what I'm used to, the skills I have, had to do with this ox goad. So he kind of thought outside the box, but yet it was inside his box, right? This is what I carry all day long. Why not use what I got? Do you think God can only do things a certain way? And that the only ministries are the ones that have familiar labels on them? You know, as a pastor, you know, we have a ministry chart, you know, and who oversees what and who does what, and you know, we add this ministry and, ooh, we need some people to help here because how can we? Those are all important things, believe me. If there's nobody in the nursery to watch the kids, that's a problem. But ministry is not limited to what happens in our programs here at Open Door Bible Church. And we got to think differently than that. I would like to think that everybody can serve to help the body in some maybe known way, but I remember years ago where there was a lady that I thought, man, she's just not involved in anything at church. And I thought she was like, you know, a little more spiritual than that. Just she wasn't involved in anything. Just wouldn't do anything. And while I was having some of those thoughts, I found out that she had the kind of ministry that most of us are afraid of. She was actually involved in a number of community things, reaching people that didn't come into this building, you know? And she was having effective ministry spiritually to other ladies through other activities, had nothing to do with the church. I'm thinking, well, if God called us to minister to reach the lost, I guess she's probably doing a better job than most of us who you know, just come do the 9:30 to 10:30 thing or whatever else. And so we got to think that way and ask ourselves, what has God called me to? It might be just distinctly me. And instead of thinking of the things that are unconventional about us, and we're all unique, instead of thinking that because I'm different, I'm therefore not useful, maybe God wants to take my differences and make me useful out of that difference, out of that uniqueness. I mean, think of it, there's a lot of unique stories in the Bible. I mean, Judges is a great place to find that. We'll meet two ladies in the next story, Deborah and Jael, and they were unique, and Apostle Paul was certainly unique, and Peter, and you know, strong personalities, and this and that. If we really knew these people, aside from their Bible names and stories, would we even recognize them, but realize how unique they are? Do we understand that God's going to take something about us, our interests, maybe even a quirk in our personality, make a ministry opportunity out of it? He will use our disabilities, our handicaps, the things we thought we had going against us. Maybe he wants to use that to show even through our weakness that he is strong. That would be kind of biblical, wouldn't it? So let's not diminish the hand we've been dealt, so to speak. Let's not assume that because we're different than so-and-so and don't fit a certain category, that God doesn't want to use us. Let's have the courage to be used from that very way, an ox goad. And finally, courage is facing fears instead of hiding from them. Instead of hiding in the trails, Shamgar was out on the road, I think. Afraid, but he faced his fear. And boy, don't we like to avoid the hard stuff, if at all possible. If it's a hard job, if it's hard to schedule, perfect excuse. I don't have the time. Hard conversation? I can't do that. Hard time financially, hard time physically. We avoid, we hide, we deny, we defend. We skirt around instead of facing what it is we fear, because God tends to work through the things we fear, not the things that we are totally in our comfort zone about. I love the verses of Psalm 56. When I'm afraid, psalmist doesn't say if I'm afraid. When I'm afraid, I will trust in you, in God whose word I praise. In God I will trust. I will not be afraid. What can mortal man do to me? Do you see the horizontal and the vertical in that verse? The vertical is mortal man. You know, we're afraid of people. We're afraid of circumstances. But the real prevailing direction of this verse is vertical, isn't it? I will trust in you, in God, whose word I praise. So if he gives me direction, in his word I will trust. I won't be afraid because I'm not going by popular opinion. I'm not worried about what somebody else says or thinks. My trust is in God. Ehud Shamgar, the willingness to trust God alone, whether anybody's standing with us or not. If we all become independently trusting God, imagine what he would then do as he melds us together in a body, a whole bunch of people courageously trusting God together and multiplying even the power of the way he can work in a single person. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we recommit ourselves to walking with you, regardless of obstacles, regardless of who goes with us. Help us not to be foolishly independent, but courageously confident in you alone. Help us to think vertically and to respond to everything that happens around us with a sense of confidence in you. In Jesus' name, amen.